This is Tom Roy with radio news from Wavefarms WGXC in New York. News about radio waves, transmission art, wireless surveillance, and other broadcast issues from wavefarm.org. With just a skeleton crew since the government shut down October 1st, the Federal Communications Commission currently has no enforcement division to react to complaints about pirate radio. Those complaints may be logged later, but the pirates may be long gone by the time the government reopens for business. So with America in a lawless state on the airwaves, is anyone monitoring pirate radio activity? The FCC keeps the records of pirate radio activity that anyone reporting about pirate radio inevitably refers to in their story. Pirates no longer like to leave internet traces. There are a few websites with information about illicit activity on the airwaves. Pirates Week, a weekly audio report about shortwave and FM pirate radio activity, comes from upstate New York's Ragnar Danneskold. Although Danneskold posts much less often every fall. Even when he doesn't post the weekly show that airs on many FM shortwave and internet stations, he does post audio files of pirate radio stations, including this one from October 1st. Pirates Week Twitter feed is also full of broadcast alerts if you'd like to know when pirates go on the air. Pirate Radio Central at blackcatsystems.com/radio/pirates.html also hosts a lively message board with information about shortwave pirates, number stations, utility stations, and more. Free Radio Cafe also has a lively forum and includes solar weather and a way to upload QSL cards. Paul Rimsmondale in Radiosurvivor.com reports that three radio activist groups are preparing to ask the Federal Communications Commission to explore the possibility of either extending or moving the low-power FM application window, preferably before the close of 2013. Right now, applicants for low-power FM stations are to file between October 15th and October 29th. But as of October 1st, the U.S. government has been shut down and the Federal Communications Commission only has a skeletal staff. That means that questions from possible applicants that are coming into the FCC right now are being lined up in a queue and will be answered in order once the government reopens. That may not give applicants enough time to get their applications together by October 15th, depending on when the government reopens, according to representatives from radio activist groups Common Frequency, Prometheus Radio, and REC Networks. Clay Leander, the president of Common Frequency, said that his group had a conference call with the FCC just before the shutdown with other groups involved in low-power FM, including the National Association of Community Broadcasters, REC Networks, Native Public Media, the National Hispanic Coalition, and the Alliance for Community Media, as well as Prometheus Radio Project. Prometheus Policy Director Sanjay Jolly said in Radiosurvivor.com that, quote, "Once the shutdown is over, we plan to press the commission to make fair accommodations to those applicants who may require additional time due to the shutdown. This might entail asking for a delay of the window," unquote. He said that, quote, "The specifics depend on when the shutdown ends, where LPFM applicants are at that point, and the FCC's audio division's capacity to get everything up and running," unquote. You can read more about this story at Radiosurvivor.com. Jennifer Waits at Radiosurvivor.com takes a look at the California Historical Radio Society and their YouTube channel, youtube.com/user/calradiohistory/videos. The California Historical Radio Society's video collection includes interviews including Carter B. Smith, Terry McGovern, Rosie Allen, Ben Fong Torres, and Stan Burford.
Hi, I'm Steve Cushman. I'm president of the California Historical Radio Society. Here we are in the Bay Area Radio Hall of Fame in the KRE building at 601 Ashby Avenue in Berkeley. A lot of these people you see here are on this YouTube page. We're proud to feature these new living histories of many of your Bay Area radio favorites. They all have something to do with radio. They all have great stories to tell. So look at them all and enjoy them.
You can see that story at radiosurvivor.com. The winners of the 2013 Third Coast Richard H. Dryhouse Foundation Story Competition were announced this week, and on October 21st, they'll announce who won what. But the winners for this year were Tim Howard with editor Jad Abumrad's WNYC Radio Lab podcast, Adoptive Couple Versus Baby Girl, Ben Calhoun, Linda Lutton, and Alex Kulowitz, with co-producer Robin Seaman and editors Ira Glass and Julie Snyder for This American Life edition Harper High School, Muj Zaidi, Brendan Baker, and Nick Vanderkolk for Love and Radio, the episode Jack and Ellen, Jesse Cox and sound engineer Russell Stapleton and supervising producer Claudia Taranto for ABC Radio National's 360 documentaries Keep Them Guessing from Australia, from the UK, Kathy Fitzgerald and Matt Thompson for Rocket House Productions and the BBC World Service, an episode called No Greater Love. Emily Kwong for the Salt Institute of Documentary Studies in Maine for Parts of Speech. Kenny Malone, Alicia Zuckerman, Dan Gresh, Sammy Mack, Trina Sargowski for WLRN Miami Herald News edition Remembering Andrew. Timoteo Fagbeni and Courtney Stein with editor Marianne McCoon for WNYC's Radio Rookies episode The Modern Scarlet Letter A, and Marianne McCoon and editor Karen Frillman for WNYC Radio for Woman Emerges from the Dark. This year's winners receive cash awards of $1,000 to $4,000 and pro editing software. They will be heard on a national broadcast of Best of the Best, the 2013 Third Coast Festival broadcast, distributed by Public Radio Fund Exchange and on a number of stations around the United States. You can go to thirdcoastfestival.org for more information. The Amateur Radio Relay League Foundation is currently accepting applications from eligible young radio amateurs pursuing higher education. More than 80 scholarships ranging from $500 to $5,000 are awarded annually, and one applicant is selected for the William R. Goldfarb Scholarship, awarded to a high school senior pursuing a degree in business, computers, medical, nursing, engineering, or science. All applicants must be active radio amateurs and must complete and submit an online application that's available at ARRL.org. That's the Amateur Radio Relay League.org. Applications are due by January 31st, 2014. Corey Groh in Rolling Stone magazine reports that Black Flag guitarist and co-founder Greg Ginn lost a lawsuit to prevent his former bandmate, including Keith Morris and Henry Rollins, from using the group's iconic bars logo and name. This past August, Ginn filed a lawsuit against the group fronted by Morris that had been using the name Flag in January, as Ginn was claiming he solely owned the hardcore group Signifier. He also included Rollins in the lawsuit, alleging the singer and Morris had attempted to trademark the band name and logo under false pretense. October 8th, a U.S. District Court judge in California denied Ginn's motion for a preliminary injunction against his former bandmates. This means Flag can continue now performing until the lawsuit is finally settled, but they have a show in Austin, Texas, November 8th, while Ginn's Black Flag have a new studio album due in January. We're here today with Heather Corcoran, the executive director of Rhizome, the new media. Well, Heather, why don't you describe what Rhizome is?
Sure. So broadly, we talk about Rhizome as dealing with contemporary art engaged with technology. We were founded in 1996 by an artist named Mark Tribe, along with a number of artists who were looking at contemporary art or art that was based on the internet. So Rhizome.org is our main platform, our main programming platform, and we started out as an internet-based organization. We're a bit broader now. We, again, look at all contemporary art engaged with technology, and we're based at the New Museum.
And I guess over the long view, internet-related art has evolved over the years. At first it seemed like every museum would have a installation of something that looked like seemed like an app or something rather than an artist project. There was a lot of that early on. How has it evolved over the years, I guess?
Well, I guess in early days, so, I mean, you can think about the history of the internet as really starting in, well, let's say 1993 is when the first Mosaic browser was launched. And so in early days, artists were really engaging with sort of the formal qualities of what the internet is, this idea of, like, global connectivity, and were quite... I would say political or like also utopian or sort of ideological about what that could mean in terms of like being very democratic, kind of challenging in making internet art, challenging what the art object could be as something ephemeral that's not scarce. So that's what I say. In earlier days, I think artists were trying to imagine what the internet could be. The relationship with the first dot-com boom, I think, was really interesting. And as you say, museums became a little bit fascinated with this shiny new thing that was the internet. And so there was a period of museums engaging with it that dropped off a little bit, I think, sort of towards the early 2000s, as they realized that, you know, this stuff wasn't stable, it would break all the time. There was, you know, they were kind of...
There was the dot-com crash at that point, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And there was probably a natural backlash.
Exactly. So I think that, yeah, well, we kind of saw that, that relationship kind of evolve over time. And then around the launch of social media, so in the mid-2000s, we really saw, again, a like re-engagement with, or a change, I guess, in the work that artists were doing on the internet to respond to the social context of the internet, also to the corporatization of the internet in some ways. It's interesting to track that over time. Now,
and you said it started utopian. I'm assuming a lot more art is Orwellian now since
times
have changed.
Certainly. Artists are thinking a lot about that, about privacy and, yes, about, privacy is a really big one. And it's really changed over time. But I think, and now there's this whole thing about post-internet art. So this idea that we're kind of in a post kind of network condition, that internet isn't something that just happens on your computer, but that it happens kind of every day and in your phones, in the air, you know, in absolutely everything. So
you're going to be wearing it soon, or if you're not already.
And just the way that we interact is so conditioned by the internet. So there's this kind of term emerging of like post-internet art, and there's a lot of artists thinking about that as well.
How has Rhizome evolved over that time too?
Well, we started out essentially as an artist project, with a lot of ambition, and with a lot of connection, I think, with a big community of artists. We started as a mailing list, actually, and then evolved into a website. And so we really started as a group of artists. We've somewhat formalized over time in terms of, you know, reaching out to a wider audience and taking a bit of curatorial leadership, or just trying to synthesize a lot of those practices so that people can gain an entry point into them. So rather than it being, in addition to it being a tight-knit kind of community, also this entry point that Rhizome can help people access. So I guess we formalized over time, and then 10 years ago we affiliated with the New Museum, so now we're based there. And obviously that's brought a lot of visibility to our work. It's really allowed us to advocate for the legitimacy of this work to the broader contemporary art audience or to a wider public. So, and I think that we're, making kind of headway with that, really.
It seems like Rhizome has always been at the forefront, I guess, of finding what the most functional way of using the internet for artists is. Like, the first it started as this list, because that was, at the time, was the best way to get to communicate. And then it became like a blog, because that became the technology that was the best to communicate this other kind of information. How do you see technology moving and Rhizome moving with technology right now?
Yeah, good question. We're in the middle of thinking about that right now. But I think... we're all, again, kind of to go back to this really kind of simple question, is that technology is becoming so embedded in absolutely everything we do. So we're kind of moving, away from this being a specialist thing that's kind of, that's specialist, to being something that's more mainstream. And so, people who are using phones or apps or who are just thinking about the implications of technologies across the board. A quirky example is that we're doing a symposium in February about e-cigarettes and about the kind of cultural implications of that. And so we're looking at kind of technology across the board. And I think that there's so many I mean, absolutely everything is being transformed by it. So therefore, artists are engaging with absolutely everything.
What is the museum's interaction with internet art these days?
Well, they've been great. I mean, they've been great champions. Do you mean the new museum especially?
But, new museum especially, yeah. But in general, the art world, that part of the art world, they had that sort of clumsy start and then got into it more. Where is the state now? Is it grown up?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, artists are always interested in engaging with the most contemporary culture, and right now that's technology culture. So I think through a natural process, not necessarily through museum leadership, but through artists themselves, the museums are engaging with technology simply because that so many artists now are thinking about that. So so definitely I think every major museum or every kind of gallery has come across or shown or spoken to an artist who's thinking about technology, just because so many people are. So I think that relationship has really become like normalized in some way. I think
there's not a specialist anymore that handles it. It's more throughout everything they do.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I think that it's moving away from these specialized new media programs that kind of happen in these special new media lounges kitted out with computers, and it's more the museums are finding different ways, and artists themselves are finding different ways of representing an engagement with technology in galleries. So it doesn't necessarily even have to use technology, but people who are using photography or video to examine kind of issues of technology or internet. So, for example, we just have a commission by an artist named Alexandra Domanovich, and she's done a short film that is looking at the history of the internet in Yugoslavia, or former Yugoslavia. She grew up there, and so and she's like a well-known contemporary artist, and shows that in galleries. So it's not using the internet per se, but it's exploring kind of the cultural implications of the internet.
Is there anything else with Rhizome that's new that you want to tell us and tell our listeners about?
Sure. One of our signature programs that we're really excited about and I'm working heavily on right now is a project called 7 on 7, where we pair 7 artists with 7 technologists and they make something new together in a day. We've been running that 4 years founded at the New Museum and running 4 years in New York. And it's been great. We've had people like the founder of Tumblr and the founder of Foursquare, paired up with artists like Ryan Tricarton or Taryn Simon. And it's been a really interesting kind of crossing between these two worlds or these two contexts, the kind of startup tech world and the art community. And we're really passionate about that because I think that technology companies are making new culture, but they need to be critical about it and kind of understand what implication it's going to have. And I think artists are really good at thinking through some of those issues. So, especially in companies that exist in New York, where those people are necessarily rubbing up against culture rather than a place like Silicon Valley, where they're a little bit more isolated. So that's a program that we've been running for 4 years, and we're doing our first edition in London, which is really exciting. So we're trying to do more international programs because we have such a big online audience that we don't want to be New York specific. We want to reach out to those international.
All right. Well, thank you for speaking with us, Heather Corcoran, the executive director of Rhizome.
In October radio history, on October 5th, 1921, the first World Series game was broadcast. On October 20th, 1947, the radio rights to the World Series were sold for 3 years for $475,000. On October 14th, 1934, the Lux Radio Theater premiered. On October 14th, 1943, Radio Corporation of America, RCA, sold the NBC Blue Radio Network to Edward Noble for $8 million. It was renamed ABC, the American Broadcasting Company. On October 17th, 1919, the Radio Corporation of America, RCA, was created. On October 20th, 1906, Dr. Lee DeForest demonstrated the electrical vacuum radio tube. October 20th, 1930, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes premiered on the NBC Radio Network.
The makers of Clippercraft Clothes for Men and 1203 leading retail stores from coast to coast presents Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's immortal character, the world's most famous detective, Sherlock Holmes, starring John Stanley.
Here
ham radio operators across the United States participated in a nationwide amateur radio simulated emergency test, or SET, sponsored by the Amateur Radio Relay League. The SET lets responders know what parts of their network are working. This simulated emergency test October 5th from 9 a.m. until noon. Here is some of the audio from this simulated emergency test Saturday, October 5th.
Calling the emergency simulation test net. Calling the emergency simulation test net. Calling the 2013 Greene County, New York, ARRL simulated emergency test net at 10:28 a.m.
Mike Dudge Weisskopf of Shortwave Music is about to release the Muezzins of Mali, compendium of field recordings made during calls to prayer, Adhan, and prayer services, Salat, throughout Mali in January 2012. Mike Dodge Weisskopf is a field recordist, radio producer, and sound artist from Los Angeles, California. In 2005, he founded Shortwave Music, a global sound series which preserves the sounds of regional and international broadcasting around the world. Here's a sample called Segoi from his recent visit to Mali.
Thank you.
Preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.